Reverend Dr. J. Emerson Johnson is an Episcopal priest, and he has been a member of the faculty at Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley for almost 15 years. He's known there as an innovator. He designed and directed for a long time the Certificate in Sexuality and Religion that PSR is well known for. He is one of the designers and really the central moving force behind a center for spiritual and social transformation that is called the Ignite Institute. And he was the architect of a new master's degree that PSR has started in theology and social transformation, which really means changing the world through our faithfulness. He is a fine teacher. You can ask Elise Swanson or Joshua Suleiman, who are two of his current students, about that. And he is my friend. We are grateful to have him here this morning to preach and then to lead a workshop beginning at 11:30 in the fireside room. And we are especially graced to have him here today because it is his birthday. Will you pray with me? May the words of Jay's mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts and the way we live our lives please you, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen.
Gather up the fragments so that nothing may be lost. It's really a delight to be here among you this morning and to spend a little bit of time reflecting with you on this remarkable passage from the Gospel according to John. I've heard many wonderful things about you from Joshua, who graces us up at PSR on campus. He's put up with my classes a couple of times. And of course, I've heard wonderful things from Kathy about you, someone from whom I have learned so much over the years and whose friendship means a great deal to me. Let me just say, though I'm sure you already know this, how blessed you are to have her here as your pastor. Enough to make me a United Methodist. Now, as something of a theology geek, I relish reading ancient texts and weaving together theological ideas into systems of interrelated doctrines. I even get paid for it. In all that textual work, though, I tried always to remember that Christian faith began not with a text, not with a doctrine, not with an institution, but with radical social practice, table fellowship. It's important to remember that in the ancient Mediterranean world, it mattered a great deal with whom one shared meals. We tend to forget this in our fast food culture today. And indeed, this was just as important as with whom one shared sexual intimacy. In those societies, food and sex were the primary ways to maintain social hierarchies of value based on ethnicity, class, gender, and religion. Remembering this, we can understand better why Jesus so often got into trouble for eating with the wrong people. He not only ignored those powerful social divisions, he dissolved those barriers by gathering around a single table with those who were not supposed to be there. It was for them a fresh and compelling insight into who God is and what God is like and what in the world it means to say that God is love. Now, after taking this meal sharing to a whole new level by feeding 5,000 people with some fish and a bit of bread, then Jesus says to his disciples, "Gather up the fragments, so that nothing is lost." It matters a great deal that this table sits right here in the midst of this space. It's a visible reminder in a deeply fragmented world about the kind of God we worship and the kind of witness we can and really must offer to the gospel. I'm reminded of why this matters whenever I listen to the ongoing debate over immigration in this country. As you may know, there is a massive fence jutting out from the west coast in Southern California between San Diego and Tijuana. That fence juts out from the shoreline into the Pacific Ocean, and it marks the U.S.-Mexico border. This fence also sits in a place rather hopefully, ironically, called Friendship Park. It has been a place over the years where divided families and separated friends could meet and chat and even have picnics together, separated by a chain link fence. First Lady Pat Nixon dedicated this park back in 1971 and declared her hope that one day the fence would come down. Think about that for a moment. Imagining a First Lady saying that today is not only difficult politically, but also logistically, because the Department of Homeland Security has been dismantling that park over the last few years to build a better fence. Meanwhile, a Methodist minister, John Fennistill, has been going every week to that park, crossing construction lines and celebrating Eucharist there, Holy Communion, and passing communion through the links of the fence. Gather up the fragments, Jesus said, so that nothing may be lost. Ancient empires and modern nation-states alike rely on the notion of acceptable losses. We sometimes hear this in the news. But not merely acceptable as if, unavoidable or unfortunate, but necessary losses, necessary exclusions, mandatory fragmentations of the human family for the sake of identity politics, and the consolidation of power. Many of us, I'm sure, have been gripped lately by images of the current refugee crisis unfolding in Europe. Lest we forget, and I know, or at least suspect, that there are some here who knew this firsthand, but lest we forget, these crises are not new. Prior to 1944, strict immigration quotas prevented hundreds of thousands of Jews from entering the United States after fleeing Germany and Poland. Most of them were sent back. Many of them died. Whether in first century Rome or 21st century America, divide and conquer is the preferred strategy of the powerful. pitting the haves against the have-nots, stoking fear over the scarcity of resources, sequestering the undesirable ones, mostly people of color, in massive incarceration programs or building taller fences. John Zezulis, a Greek Orthodox theologian, urges us to reflect on these dynamics of division whenever we gather around this table, whenever we see this table and what it represents in our midst. In the Eucharist, he says, we become church, the place where faith, hope, and love are no longer my possessions to protect, but rather our common possessions to share. Zezulis puts it this way. In the Eucharist, quote, the human ceases to be an individual and becomes a person. That is to say, a reality which is not a fragment. That's a striking way to put it, it seems to me. We are no longer fragments around this table or in this place because we are persons. Persons are made for communion. Gather up the fragments, Jesus said, so that nothing may be lost. The distress and consternation over socio-political divisions can, it seems to me, reflect the fear that many of us harbor about our own personal fragmentations. The anxiety over holding together all the many, often disparate pieces of our lives and relationships. I cannot help but think of my dear 93-year-old mother, who died just this past March after living for a number of years with Alzheimer's-related dementia. It was painful, I have to say, to travel with her on that journey as I watched and listened to the fabric of her memory, once a whole cloth of rich experiences and relationships, slowly unravel. The seams of that colorful quilt coming apart as one piece after another fell away. It was painful, but also a privilege to be the one picking up the pieces she dropped, gathering up the fragments of her life and telling the stories again and again, quite literally remembering her life with her from moment to moment. And of course, worrying about what I myself may have forgotten, what pieces may have fallen away unnoticed, a cherished fragment that was sloughed off and now unseen in the corner of the room. That kind of fear and anxiety can really tempt us to despair, especially when we're convinced that everything really is up to us. I can hear that kind of anxiety in the disciples from this morning's story. How can we possibly feed all these people? What are we going to do? The answer is disarmingly simple. Do what you can with what you've got. God does the rest. Gather up the fragments, Jesus says. That's what we do. And when we do, God will ensure that nothing is lost. John's gospel is rather strange compared to the other three. And for more than one reason. As I often say in my classes, maybe Joshua's even heard me say this, John reminds me of that old Sesame Street song, "One of these is not like the others." John, for example, does not include a Last Supper narrative in his gospel account, not in the same way that the other three gospel writers do. John's Jesus does not say, "This is my body and this is my blood." Instead, as you might recall, John's Jesus washes feet at the Last Supper and says, "Love each other. Just love each other." So, does this mean there's actually no Eucharist in the Gospel according to John? No. Quite a few scholars and commentators over the centuries have suggested that nearly every chapter in John's Gospel points toward the Eucharist, discloses yet another layer of Eucharistic meaning, invites ever deeper participation in God's own abundant life and love. Some have argued that the chapter we heard from this morning, John chapter 6, with the familiar feeding of the 5,000 with 5 loaves and 2 fish, that this is John's Eucharist story. Notice that John's Jesus took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed them. This is exactly what the other three gospel writers say about Jesus at the Last Supper. Gave thanks, and that verse comes from the Greek verb eucharistein, which is, of course, the word from which we derive our word Eucharist. This is John's Eucharist story that we heard this morning. Notice as well that rather than violence, sacrifice, and death, John puts Eucharist in the context of feeding hungry people, ensuring that absolutely everyone is fed and that no one, not a single one, is left out. And do notice, pause for a moment just to say, in gospel texts, we need to pay attention to every single word and sentence. There's no fluff in gospel texts. It's not like they got an assignment from a teacher and, you know, they were supposed to write 2,000 words and they were having trouble getting them back, but they just like put filler in there. No, there's nothing like that in the gospel texts. Every sentence, every word, every image counts. And so notice here in this story that the leftovers from this miraculous feeding amount not to 11, not to 13, but to exactly 12 baskets of leftovers. Just as there are 12 tribes of Israel, just as there are 12 disciples. 12. John thus includes even Judas the betrayer in that number. "Gather up the fragments," Jesus says, "so that nothing may be lost." Nothing will be lost, not even the one who betrayed him. The good news of the gospel is good, and it's news, and it's also a bit troubling at times. Exactly how much room is there really at this table? How much room can we bear to make around this table? Not even the gospel writers were able fully to digest the idea that Judas himself belonged at the table. And still, and perhaps despite himself, John makes clear in this chapter that the Eucharist stands for divine abundance. And not just the abundance of food. John means the utterly unmerited, wildly excessive, and shockingly profligate abundance of God's love and grace extended to all, even the betrayers. This, I dare say, in our world today would not just be countercultural, but world-changing. Dissolving borders, welcoming the stranger, becoming persons, dismantling barriers, unimaginable love and forgiveness. These are just a few of the ways that this table matters and how it shapes our lives together in a fragmented and violent world, a world that is in desperate need of what this table means. I'm very grateful for multiple meanings and approaches because it helps to ensure that each of us, in all of our diversity, can find a way to the table of divine abundance. God will and does ensure a way to God's own life and love, a way that is particularly suited to you and to me, so that in the end, nothing and no one will be lost. Amen.